From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For some 50 years now, affirmative action has been part of college life and admissions in America, and with it, a long debate. Twice in the last decade, opponents have fought their way to the Supreme Court, and racial preferences have stood. This week, tomorrow, the High Court will look at affirmative action yet again in the case of Fisher versus University of Texas. And this time, affirmative action may just become history. This hour on Point, affirmative action in our colleges and in our highest court again. You can join the conversation. Do we still need affirmative action? Is it working? Has it stayed too long? What's fair here? What's right? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first to help us bone up on all the legal history of affirmative action and what's going on right now is Joan Biskupic, legal affairs reporter for Reuters and a longtime Supreme Court watcher. She's written two books of her own on the Supreme Court, one on Sandra Day O'Connor, one on Antonin Scalia. Joan Biskupic, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Thanks, Tom. How are you?
Very, very good. What's the case here that the court's looking at, Joan?
Well, it began when a young woman by the name of Abigail Fisher wanted to go to Texas's flagship university, the University of Texas at Austin.
Yeah.
She applied in 2008, 4 years ago, to be a freshman either in business administration or the liberal arts program.
Mm-hmm.
She had a 3.59 GPA and about 1,100 on the SAT, and she didn't get in. She ended up having to go to Louisiana State University, where she graduated in May, and in her case against the University of Texas at Austin, she says she was turned down because she was white. She points to minority students with lower scores who were offered admission. And she's challenging the program, saying that it violates the Constitution's guarantee of equal protection of the law. And just so you know, Tom, there are two components to this program that people will be hearing about. The first part is called the Top 10 program, and that guarantees admission to roughly the top 10% of all high school students throughout Texas. And
this is just a state program. It's a particular to Texas program. So top 10% from each school, they're in.
That's exactly right. And that gets a lot of diversity because, of course, many of the schools are still regionally segregated.
And racially and ethnically segregated.
Exactly. But the university says it needs more than that top 10. It needs the second component, and this is the component that's at issue in the lawsuit. And this part looks at race of a student to ensure diversity on campus, to give Texas more of a diverse student population, more Hispanics, more African Americans. But what the university is saying is, in part two, it looks fully at the student across, you know, at the individual's background, geography, experience, extracurriculars.
Okay.
But it does take into account race, and that's what's at issue here.
So take us to the sort of state of play in high court terms on this, Joan. They last heard a case on this in 2003. It was
exactly
a 5-4 decision. Your Sandra Day O'Connor, was the deciding vote, wrote the opinion. What did they say then?
It was narrowly decided, and essentially what Sandra Day O'Connor did was affirm Bakke back from 1978, which many of your listeners will recall, and said, you know, while quotas are forbidden, schools may use race as one factor in the admissions decision as officials look at the whole individual. And she really stressed the idea of pathways being open to all individuals. And she had a wonderful line about, in order to cultivate a set of leaders with legitimacy in the eyes of the citizenry, mm-hmm. it's necessary that the path to leadership be visibly open to all.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, as you just said, Tom, it was a tight decision, and Sandra Day O'Connor ends up leaving the court in January 2006. She's succeeded by Samuel Alito, who is more conservative than she is.
Now, that was a close. That was 5-4. That was 2003. They were talking about Sandra Day O'Connor about wanting to see a critical mass of minority students.
Yes, she made the point that you need to, as I said, you know, have a both the critical mass and for people to see that the campus is visibly open to talented and qualified individuals of every race and ethnicity. She put a real emphasis on that. Now, one thing that you're probably aware that we should mention to listeners is that not only will she not be on the court for this case, but it will be heard by only 8 of the 9 justices, because Elena Kagan, who was Barack Obama's second appointee to the Supreme Court in 2010, is out because she had been U.S. Solicitor General and had been involved in this case when it was coming up to the lower courts. So you're going to have an eight-member court minus critical vote Sandra Day O'Connor, minus another person who would probably be sympathetic to this kind of affirmative action, Elena Kagan. So it's going to be close.
How are you and others who follow the court closely reading this? I mean, could affirmative action go down here? What would that vote likely look like? Could it be a tie? What happens then?
Yes, that's a critical question, because if they split 4-4, the lower court ruling below is upheld. And critical in this case, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit endorsed the Texas program and said it was okay.
That is, so, they endorsed racial preferences, affirmative action.
Yes, exactly right. The second component in which the admissions officials look at race. So if they split, it would be upheld. But here's the key part. They probably won't get that fourth vote unless it's Anthony Kennedy. And as you're well aware, Justice Kennedy is a swing vote on this court. He doesn't like race-based policies, but he has shown more openness to them in education, as a matter of fact.
So are you're suggesting there's a real chance that they'll go against this and the racial preferences go down?
I am, but with this strong caveat. Anthony Kennedy was on the opposite side of Sandra Day O'Connor in the 2003 Grutter versus Bollinger case.
The Michigan case.
He voted against the Michigan program. But I just want to say that I think he is in play, because the Michigan program did look at numbers more than this Texas one, arguably. And I know both of your panelists are going to go back and forth on some of the facts and exactly what goes on in the ground. On the ground in Austin, but I don't think the door is shut on Anthony Kennedy for this case. But it's true that he has sent plenty of signals saying that he is against anything that racial policies. But I do think if he's open to persuasion, it's in the education context.
If the High Court, the Supreme Court, goes with Abigail Fisher here, young Abigail, and says this is wrong, and it's would that mean saying it's time for affirmative action to end? And what would the consequences of that be, Joan?
Well, if it goes all the way and broadly rules that you cannot use any of these racial considerations at all in school, yep. It would affect probably more than 40 state school systems that still allow some sort of race-based consideration.
Because it's public universities we're talking about here.
Yes, it is. Although some of the private schools, you know, the schools like Amherst, you know, a lot of small lib arts and larger schools have entered it, stressing the importance of looking at race in this context, along with many other factors. So it could be quite significant if the court rules broadly. If the court says only that the way Texas conducts its program is invalid, then it's limited only to Texas, of course.
They'll hear the arguments tomorrow, and a ruling likely to come when on the calendar?
Well, they usually recess at the end of June, and as we know, the hardest cases come then. So even though they're hearing it relatively early in the term, we might not get it until next spring.
Joan Biskupic covers the Supreme Court for Reuters. She spoke with us from Washington. Joan, you're great. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
With us now from Washington, Stuart Taylor, legal affairs columnist for the National Journal, co-author of the new book just out today, Mismatch: How Affirmative Action Hurts Students, It's Intended to Help, and Why Universities Won't Admit It. Stuart Taylor, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Tom. Nice to be here.
And with me in the studio is Randall Kennedy, professor at Harvard Law School, one of the country's leading scholars on race relations and the law, author of the books The Persistence of the Color Line, Sellout, and many more. His new book on affirmative action will be out in the spring. Randall Kennedy, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We'll get to the arguments. We've just got a couple minutes before the break. Randall Kennedy, first to you. In its last decision, the court did kind of put a clock on affirmative action, said this should not go on forever, as I understand its last 2003 ruling. Do we still need, before we even get to the legal arguments, do we still need affirmative action, Randall?
Yes, we still need affirmative action, because without affirmative action, the numbers of racial minority students at selective universities would go way down.
And the consequence of that would be for the universities, for the country?
Well, we would go back to the days of a negligible number of students in strategic institutions in American life, that helped seed the power elite in America.
The path to leadership, as
yes.
Senator Day O'Connor put it. Stuart Taylor, how are you looking at this? The court's going to sit down. They're going to hear about it tomorrow. They're going to decide probably early in the summer. Do we still need affirmative action, Stuart?
I'd say yes, but in a different sense than what Randy means. First, affirmative action used to mean, originally meant, social mobility, helping racial minorities and others who are poor and have lacked opportunity. It's morphed over the years into a program largely for fairly affluent minorities who are elevated over less affluent, better qualified whites and Asians. And so affirmative action has really become a system of very large racial preferences. As to how large, the universities, including Texas, try to obfuscate this. But at Texas, for example, in the relevant group of students accepted outside the top 10% plan in 2009, the racial gaps between blacks and Asians were 467 points.
What do you mean by what? Oh, I see. Between those admitted with racial preferences
Between those who actually enrolled, between the blacks who enrolled and the Asians who enrolled.
And that's because you're saying blacks were given more of a boost under their racial preference program.
That's because they're not only given a racial preference; they're given a huge racial preference. Now, I'll just quickly add one thing. I agree that it would be terrible to see a huge drop in racial numbers. That's one reason my co-author and I do not call for banning affirmative action. We do call for various reforms that would limit the size of the racial gaps and that would be good for students of all races, we think.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about affirmative action and admissions policies across the country and headed again before the United States Supreme Court tomorrow. Randall Kennedy is with us from Harvard Law School. He's got a big book coming out next year on race and affirmative action and the law. Stuart Taylor is with us from Washington, D.C. He's got a big book just out today, Mismatch, which is not making the case for affirmative action as practiced right now. Randall Kennedy, look at this court. And we'll come to the sort of bigger picture of affirmative action in the country. But look at the membership of the court. Take Elena Kagan out because she was in the Solicitor General's office. She worked on this case, so she's recused herself. What do you see coming in the debate, the decision here, potentially?
I think that the Supreme Court of the United States will reverse the lower court and will strike down the affirmative action plan, the explicit racial affirmative action plan at the University of Texas. But that will be a rather narrow ruling that will have limited effects throughout the nation because there are very few places that have a percent plan like Texas does.
You know? That is that the top 10% of each school can go to the University of Texas, and because so many of those schools are heavily populated by one race or another, one ethnicity or another, that in effect means lots of African Americans, Hispanic, you name it, end up there even before you get to racial preference as a beyond that.
That's right. So if you're in Texas, you get an automatic ticket to the University of Texas system if you're in the top 10% of your class.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one thing that should be noted, that wasn't just accidental. The reason why the Texas legislature enacted this plan is because a number of years ago, mm-hmm. a court had told the University of Texas, you cannot take race into account.
Right. But they knew what the
complexion numbers of their went
schools
way, the were. Numbers yeah. went way down, yeah. and the Texas legislature said, to its credit, in mm-hmm. my view, mm-hmm. we need to have some way of getting minority students into our program, into the University of Texas. So they came up with this percentage plan.
Which, the way American schools in many states work, certainly in Texas, amounts to a kind of affirmative action. They understood that.
Very much so. Very much so. And so I think what this case is really about is, if you have a percentage plan, can you layer on top of that percentage plan a plan that explicitly takes race into account as a plus? And I think the Supreme Court is going to say, no, you can't do that.
Well, Stuart, in that case, how unique is Texas in the particular design of its plan? Maybe this won't be such a sweeping consequential ruling after all.
Well, actually, California has moved toward a similar plan, and others have too. I agree with Randy Kennedy that mm-hmm. the court's not going to outlaw affirmative action. Justice Kennedy, as Joan Biskupic explained, has never indicated he would go that far. But I do think it's quite possible that they will go farther than Professor Kennedy thinks.
In what
I don't
regard?
Think they're just going. There are other objections to the University of Texas plan that I think will appeal to Justice Kennedy beyond the fact that it's layered on top of this 10% plan.
Mm-hmm.
One is the court itself in the last big case laid down a couple of principles that it didn't really enforce, but I think Justice Kennedy might now. The first is no racial balancing. You cannot try and mirror the state's population percentages in terms of race at the university, and that's an explicit objective, long-term objective of the University of Texas. Another is to have a critical mass, as they call it, of every racial group in every classroom. Now, that's a nice idea, except that it would mean continuing these kinds of racial preferences for maybe 50, 100 or years or longer, and the court has them on a timetable to be phased out by 2028, 16 years. That's not happening anywhere in the United States if present trends continue, especially at Texas.
So within the context of this Texas case that they will be looking at, what's the broadest impact ruling that you could foresee, Stuart?
I could foresee the court putting real teeth in those limitations on racial balancing and on perpetual racial preferences. Now, how you would formulate that is a tricky business because, you know, how large is too large a racial preference is what it largely comes down to. And by the way, we think in our book, we argue that large racial preferences are harming students of all races, that because the supposed beneficiaries are being put out of their depth academically. I can see the court trying for the first time to do something that really limits the size, and we've proposed a couple of reforms in our book and in our legal brief that we think would help do that. One is total transparency.
Well, hold on to that for a second. We'll pull the curtain back and look at those recommendations, but I want to understand here, are you suggesting that if the court says no racial balancing, that is, you can't have a policy that tries to mirror the racial makeup of your state, could they end up, this is a court that's been sometimes surprisingly ambitious and sweeping, could they end up actually tossing out Texas's top 10 policy, 10% policy?
Certainly not in this case, because it hasn't been challenged in this case. There are some who would toss that policy out, too. And by the way, that policy has some problems, apart from legal problems. But I think that's a long way down the road before that gets challenged, because there are no individual is considered on the basis of race into the top 10 plan. Obviously, the reason they did it was to get the top 10% of the kids in mostly black and Hispanic schools. That's why they did it. But it's not couched in racial terms, and it has an egalitarian component, which is you're taking kids who did well in the environments they were born into.
Yeah,
there's some value in that.
Yeah, point taken. But this is a court that some of the members kind of pride themselves on looking at obvious things and saying, let's talk about it. Randy?
It is possible that there could be a broader ruling. I don't think they'll do this, but it is possible that they will say, listen, let's reconsider our 2003 opinion in Michigan. I mean, mm-hmm. It was a close opinion. The court has had a change of personnel. The person who wrote Grutter mm-hmm. is no longer on the court. She, Sandra Day O'Connor, has been replaced by Samuel Alito. It's possible. I don't think they'll do this, but it is possible. They'll say, let's reconsider what we did in 2003, and let's reverse ourselves.
So we're going to listen. We're going to watch. And the scope of change here, kind of unpredictable. Randall Kennedy, Stuart Taylor, please stand by. We've got lots of callers here. Savannah, Georgia, Jay is calling. Jay, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yes, I was just curious. I remember when I was applying for college, I applied in November of my senior year and to University of Georgia. I, of course, live in Georgia. And I found out after I was denied that my guidance counselor told me I should have applied my junior year because of the number of applications they got and to increase my chances. So okay. I wonder, in her situation, if she applied early enough. And also, I wondered if, you know, she's going to sue for this, for the racial, you know, affirmative action, if she's going to take on also, like, legacies, because they also get preferential treatment.
You mean students in, I don't know if that's at public schools, but certainly some private schools. If one of your parents went, you may have an advantage. Jay, let me ask you, do you come to this from any particular race or family background that matters here, white, black, other?
Well, actually, I'm multiracial, Tom. My mother's Korean, and my father was black. And I also applied to some minority colleges, historically black colleges, universities.
Yeah.
I ended up getting accepted to Morgan State, and I applied there as an Asian because they did not have multiracial as one of the options.
Wow. So you've got a lot going on here. How did you, as one individual in this big American system, how did you think about it? Did you think, okay, well, mom, dad, thinking to yourself, what should I put down here? What's going to be most advantageous? You know, Asian American, African American?
Well, I did take that into account. And if they had multiracial, I did select multiracial on my applications. But when they didn't, I did take advantage of, you know, the opportunity that I had because of my diversity. Personally, I feel that affirmative action kind of puts an advantage for minorities, but it's one of those things that you can't, because of the history that the United States has, you can't quantify how long it's going to take for the setbacks that were put in place for African Americans to be, you know, rectified and say that, you know, we're past, you know, the belief that
that legacy. You talk about legacies. There's yet another legacy, a big legacy of history. You know, Jay, I mean, I almost hate to let you go. You're such an interesting case because in no small number of colleges, I think now, you've got very heavy Asian American representation, and you still got this push to get more African American representation. You really bring us the complexity of the American situation, Jay.
Yes, yeah. Well, you know, I also took into account when applying, especially to historically black colleges, knowing that the student body would mostly be made up of black students, that the fact that I was Asian would give me a leg up.
Wow. Jay, we wish you luck, and I appreciate your call. Randy, what do you hear in this caller's story?
Well, this caller's story does highlight a big change since the 1970s, and that is demographic change. And one of the things that's going to be a challenge to the affirmative action systems that we have.
Because it's not simple in any regard.
No, it's
anymore.
Not simple. I mean, we're having completely new social formations take root.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're going to have to get used to that, and we're going to have to make accommodations for that.
I'll bring it to you as well, Stuart. Let me get one more first. Katie in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Katie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just graduated from my university in May.
Congratulations.
And when I was initially applying for colleges when I was a senior in high school,
yeah.
I applied for a bunch of ones with different academic and competitive levels. And I feel that I was pretty qualified to get into some of these schools, but I was getting waitlisted, whereas other of my peers who were of different minority were getting accepted over me.
Yep.
And, you know, this is still kind of fresh on my mind, even though it's 4 years later. And I remember just being really, really mad and really frustrated. But when I was a freshman at my college that I went to, I took a class in the social justice field, and I remember turning my view 360 degrees.
Why?
And, well, the class that we talked about, there are a lot of people in my community in particular who are Hispanics, and their parents work shifts all day. Parents are rarely home. These kids are taking care of their siblings. They're taking care of each other, and they don't have the same opportunities that I had. I was lucky enough to have parents who took me to extracurriculars that boosted my resume, that really got me involved. I was lucky to have them to push me to study, to help me when I had problems. But there are so many kids in my area who don't have the same opportunities, who don't have parents to push them just because they're not home. Some of them don't speak English. And a lot of these kids, they have college nowhere on their spectrum, nowhere on their radar. They have no idea because they don't have that extra push.
So you turned around from resentment to openness to this. How much? For how long, Katie? How long should it go on in this country?
I mean, I think that it's important to go on as long as it can just because, I mean, it's just getting worse. We're getting in more unequal standards as far as Hispanics and other minorities having to work more and more and more because they keep getting pushed down because of some other obstacles that are keeping them from remaining competitive. So I think as long as we're untreated equally before college, as far as the opportunities we have, that's how long affirmative action needs to continue to make sure we are, I mean, treated with different standards as we're applying to the next level.
Wow.
In mind.
That sounds like potentially forever and a day. Katie, it's an interesting arc that your thinking took, and I appreciate your call. Stuart Taylor, roll your thesis out for us a bit here. In the new book, it's out today, it's called Mismatch, and you are saying that affirmative action actually hurts students, it's intended to help. You know, Katie started out white, high school graduate, resentful of racial preferences, ended up changing her mind. What do you say, Stuart?
Well, she has a lot of interesting things to say, and so did Jay. I would emphasize a couple of things. She's seen the benign side of affirmative action. She didn't see all the Asians who were kept out of her school by affirmative action.
Why are they kept out?
Because they, more so than whites, are the groups who do best academically in high school and who therefore are most likely to be squeezed out by racial preferences.
Okay.
Many black and Hispanic students do great in college, but statistically, it's pretty clear that a great many don't do well because they were accepted to colleges that are more competitive than they were ready for. It's not that they shouldn't be going to college. It's a question of who goes to which college. And
what's the downside of that? Don't they? It's like dig in, catch up.
They don't dig in, catch up. By and large, again, we're dealing with large statistical averages. There are exceptions. Mm-hmm. By and large, the affirmative action kids fall further behind while in college. They're likely to be in the bottom 20% of their class. If they wanted to be scientists, which a great many do, by the way, they're likely to find the science courses too difficult because they're surrounded by science geniuses in some of these schools, and they're good students but not quite geniuses. If they were at less competitive schools, they'd be more able to stay in sciences, they'd get better grades. If they're in law school, they'll be more likely to pass the bar exam. And so we think there's kind of an unknown, a hidden cost. And in fact, we think, my co-author Rick Sander and I think, the main victims of racial preferences and admissions are not whites like Abby Fisher, although she's a victim in a sense. They're not these Asians I'm talking about. The main victims are the underqualified black kids and Hispanic kids who are misled by the universities into improving their racial headcounts by going to universities where they're many of them are destined to struggle academically. This is hidden and concealed from them, and one of the remedies we suggest is making enough information public so that they can make more informed choices.
Randall Kennedy, that turns everything on its head. What do you make of that perspective, that depiction of reality maybe not spoken of so much? I don't know.
Well, a couple things. First of all, I think that Stuart Taylor and his co-author have a point. I'm sure that there is, in certain instances, mismatch. I am a proponent. I'm a champion of affirmative action, but that doesn't mean that I'm a champion of every affirmative action program in the
Sure.
United States. You can have badly designed affirmative action, and if you admit students who are clearly, you know, not able to hack it, that's not doing a favor for anyone. And so to the extent that that is happening, that obviously needs to be re-engineered. On the question of affirmative action kids, I am an affirmative action kid. I have been an affirmative action kid at various stages.
Because of race or?
Oh, because of race, sure. I've had a very privileged education. I went to Princeton. Mm-hmm. I went to Yale Law School.
Mm-hmm.
I teach at Harvard University. I've been there for 28 years now. At each of those places, I'm sure that the affirmative action ethos provided a boost for me.
So what does that say to you? What do you take from that?
I've been tremendously helped by it, and I think that my work and that my career suggests that for me and for a lot of people like me, affirmative action has been good not only for me personally, but has been good in a wider way. If it's the I agree that there should be transparency and people should be able to make a choice, but give them that choice to make.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about affirmative action and admissions policies across the country and headed again before the United States Supreme Court. They will hear arguments tomorrow. This year, we will have a new decision one way, one kind, or another on the future of affirmative action. Stuart Taylor is with us, co-author of the new book out today, Mismatch, How Affirmative Action Hurts Students It's Intended to Help and Why Universities Won't Admit It. There's an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Randall Kennedy is with us from Harvard Law School. He's got a big book coming out on affirmative action and law next spring. Abigail Fisher is the young woman from Texas who didn't get in. She says it's because of racial preferences in Texas. She ended up going to Louisiana. She's out now. She's doing just fine. She's got a job. Here's her voice, though, from an online ad produced by a group called Project on Fair Representation. You'll hear Abigail and then a narrator.
I dreamt of going to UT ever since the second grade. My dad went there, my sister went there, and tons of friends and family, and it was a tradition I wanted to continue.
The University of Texas admissions policy, which considers race as a factor for admission, goes before the U.S. Supreme Court in October 2012. The case, number 11-345, Abigail Fisher versus the University of Texas at Austin.
And that's where we are right now. It goes before that court tomorrow. Here's Bill Powers, president of the University of Texas at Austin, in February, responding to the Supreme Court's decision to hear the case Fisher versus the University of Texas.
We have a holistic admissions process that helps us serve all of the populations of the state of Texas. It is very narrowly tailored, and it follows previous statements by the U.S. Supreme Court on how an admissions process meets our constitutional requirements, and we will continue to make those points as we proceed with this litigation so we can best serve the people of Texas.
The Supreme Court membership has changed a lot since the last time the court ruled, and it is kind of up in the air what we're going to see here. Lorraine is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Lorraine, thanks very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, what I wanted to say is that the role of education in higher education institutions is not just to get students in based on numbers. It's also to serve the society as a whole. I am an attorney, and I can tell you that diversity is greatly needed in the legal profession.
Mm-hmm.
And without affirmative action, people's lives can be affected by decisions by people who lack a certain perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if you get rid of affirmative action, it will greatly hurt society. I'm an attorney, and I went to a school in the West Coast where affirmative action was a very hot topic.
Mm-hmm.
And I passed the bar the first time. I clerked with the judge. I came to Tennessee. I'm doing relatively well here.
Good.
And I think had it not been for affirmative action, that I wouldn't be where I am, even though I'm a veteran. I probably got veteran's preference, too,
yep,
when I applied for law school. But I think that it greatly helped because it helped me relate to my clients better. Even law firms, when they hire people, they like diversity because companies like diversity.
Yeah, no, we can all understand that. Counselor Lorraine, if you'll stick with us for a second, I'd like Stuart Taylor to respond to your story, and then I'd like to bring you back in here, Lorraine. But Stuart, what do you say to that?
It's a good point. But, you know, one of the ironies that my co-author Rick Sanders' work has uncovered is there's a very good case to be made that if we had smaller racial preferences in law school admissions, there would be more black lawyers.
Why?
Now, how could that be?
Mm-hmm.
There would clearly be fewer blacks admitted to law school. The studies suggest 15% or so fewer, give a few percent.
Okay.
You know, that you know, and larger numbers would be going to less competitive law schools than they do now, but the numbers suggest that a much higher percentage of those people would pass the bar exam. As of now, fewer than 50% of black students entering law school ever become lawyers. If they were in law schools where they were programmed to do well, law schools where they were competitive, that percent would rise. And so, you know, this is a little bit counterintuitive. But we think that's one of the problems of mismatch is you're taking people and you're programming, you're kind of setting them up to fail, people who are quite capable of succeeding and, for example, becoming lawyers, passing the bar exam, having great careers.
Hold that thought. There's something in the logic slightly eluding me still there. But, Lorraine, what do you make of that argument?
Well, I don't agree with the assertion that minorities who happen to go to competitive law schools don't do as well. I went to a law school who's ranked 23 in the nation.
Mm-hmm, pretty good.
I passed the bar the first time. I did pretty well. And I think that the assumption that there are a lot of minorities going to this school is false. I mean, there were only 6 minorities in my school. The year after me, there were 3. And the year after me, there was 1. So I don't think that there's this large number, this influx of minorities going to the top schools who are not making it. If his numbers say, okay, 50% of them are passing, you have to look at the numbers he's dealing with, because the school that I went to, there were maybe 15, 1L, it may have been 1 1L, you know, 3
yep.
3Ls, and
yeah.
3 2Ls, and 6 3Ls. I mean, that was 10 people.
Yeah.
Look, so if 5 people fail the bar, you know, you have this 50% ratio. So I don't know how accurate his numbers reflect how many people are actually going to these top schools.
Lorraine, we're really glad for your perspective right here today, and I thank you for your calls so much from Nashville. Randall Kennedy, I mean, you're in the law school arena. What do you hear?
Well, first of all, it should be known that the studies by Sander and Taylor and others who propound this mismatch thesis, very controversial. There's some people who agree with their methodology. There's some people who don't. I'm willing to take their methodology. Let's suppose that what they say is true. Then the question becomes, well, what do we do with that? It seems to me that what we do with that is we say, listen, maybe we need to re-engineer to some degree our affirmative action policies. One thing that we don't need to do, however, is get rid of affirmative action. After all, I mean, I've just read the book by Stu Taylor and Richard Sander, mm-hmm. and for one thing, they concede that at the most elite places, for instance, the school for which I work, yeah. Harvard Law School, yeah. they concede that at those schools, this mismatch thesis is really at its weakest, that, you know, students who get into the most elite schools get a tremendous benefit. And if we do away with affirmative action, that tremendous benefit for people who come from historically disadvantaged groups will be lost.
Is it the top schools or the big body of schools you're most focused on, Stuart? Does it matter?
Well, it's the big body of schools. What Randy Kennedy says is quite correct. The racial gaps, which we think are the real problem in terms of harming black students, are smallest at places like Harvard. They get much larger as you get down to the 30, 40, 50 ranked school. You know, there's
which in some ways matters a lot more for a lot more people. I mean, you know.
It matters for a lot more people. You know, basically by sucking up a disproportionate amount of the talent that would do well at Georgetown and so forth, places like Harvard are creating problems down the line. Now, if you're Randy Kennedy and you're at Harvard, you look around the campus, you may see people who look like they're doing fine, but you're not seeing that. Now, could I just quickly go back to something you said earlier?
Yes.
Which is that if Randy Kennedy was an affirmative action kid, then I'm for that kind of affirmative action. But I know a little bit about him and his brother Henry, who is a good friend of mine in college, and I would bet that both of them would have gotten into the same places they got into regardless of race. They're both, as far as I can tell, outstanding students. And you know, I certainly have no problem with that. I don't have a great problem with a fairly sort of a tie-breaking type of affirmative action. And I want to go back to one thing you said, mm-hmm. Tom. At the beginning, you said, is it working? What's fair? What's right? I wrote that down.
Yeah.
Because that encapsulates a big part of our argument. The argument about affirmative action, racial preferences, has been about what's fair, what's right. And that's a good argument, both sides. It's an ideological argument. People are locked into their positions. People don't change their minds about this sort of thing much. Is it working is a different question. Is it helping the people it's supposed to be helping, or is it helping most of them? Is it hurting some of them? How could it be changed in ways that might be better for them? These are practical, pragmatic, evidentiary questions about which reasonable people ought to make some progress, be able to make some progress, as opposed to having just sort of an ideological standoff.
Well, fair enough. But what often gets raised here is the idea, and this is kind of how Abigail put it, at least from her perspective in this Texas case of, look, let's just do this on merit, just on merit. Let's look at your grades, let's look at your scores, and let that be that. And, you know, I know that you've got people who say that's the future we need to get to, and yet we all know we've got all kinds of different qualities of schools. We've got different regional economic profiles, family economic profiles, and this is not just race-based, you know, interestingly.
Yeah,
Randy says he's an affirmative action kid. You know, I have to say, I mean, I think I am too. I was you know, lots of colleges look for geographic diversity. They look for cultural diversity. I was a, you know, from the sort of farm kid from the boondocks. I'm sure that I fit some kind of preference schema or diversity schema at the time that I went to university. So I don't feel like I'm above and beyond all that.
See, this isn't I don't disagree with that. And just as Randy Kennedy conceded there's something to our argument, I concede there's a lot to his argument. I'm not really representative of the abolitionist school on racial preferences. There are a lot of very smart, well-meaning people, Roger Clegg, the Thernstroms, et cetera, who say just ban it. And they have strong arguments, and that's what Abigail Fisher says. I'm just not quite persuaded that the costs of banning it wouldn't outweigh the benefits. I'm looking for in-between solutions.
Something in between. Nicholas in Charleston, South Carolina. Nicholas, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say that I believe that racial preference, either positive or negative, has adverse effects for either side it's affecting. I think to look at a student and say, well, statistically your race does better, so you'll be okay, is not giving them necessarily a fair shake.
You mean looking at a white student and say, you'll be all right even without getting in here? Is that what you mean?
Exactly, yes. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I don't think that affirmative action will go away tomorrow, but I do think we should be looking towards a future in which we rely on it less. I feel that, you know, if someone succeeds or graduates, they don't do it on the merit of their race, so they shouldn't necessarily be admitted on the merit of their race. I think that, I guess, a more beautiful future would be one in which we encourage diversity and give students the tools they need at a very young age, so when they get to college, their race should not matter.
That would be beautiful. Of course, the world is less than perfectly beautiful or arranged, but point taken and a good one, Nicholas. One more right here, Jaron in Nashua, New Hampshire. Jaron, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I wanted to kind of follow along those same lines. Is that we're in the 21st century, and we shouldn't be focusing so much on whether or not someone's white or African-American or Hispanic or any of those races. It should be focused more on this person grew up in a broken home and didn't have the opportunities to have these extracurricular activities, but he or she is still intelligent enough to go to college. It should focus on people that actually need the help instead of saying, oh, I feel bad for this poor African-American. He was, if 50 years ago, he would have not been able to go to college. We should help him now in the future.
So you say do it on an economic basis? What do you mean? Like the lower the income, the more the favorable treatment?
Maybe not necessarily just economic, but look at the individual person. Let's say you're a just out of high school graduate, but you have raised your younger brother for your entire life, so you haven't been able to afford going to extracurricular classes or anything that would make you look better to college, but you still did well at high school. Like, that person obviously will do well in college and further on in life.
Jaron, I like the subtlety of the way you're thinking. Randall Kennedy, can we get down to this level of nuance in admissions so that color in itself would not be the thing on the thumb on the scale?
A couple things. First of all, the schools with which I'm most familiar, the admissions officers do exactly what your caller was just talking about. They do take into account individuals who apply and look at everything. Second of all, with respect to the racial issue, in my view, we are still at a point in American history where we still need rectification to reckon with the history of past racial injustice. We are still grappling with that burden. That burden is still on us. It has not been taken away. We still need to be attentive to the problem of integrating the strategic key institutions in American life. We still need to be interested in legitimating the key institutions of American life, just like Justice O'Connor said, to make people think and appropriately think that, you know, we're all in it together. Finally, there's the diversity argument. You know, at the Supreme Court, the talk is going to be all diversity talk. Frankly, I think it's the least compelling reason for affirmative action. Unfortunately, that's the argument with which we are most stuck.
What's the distinction you're making between diversity and this kind of key integration of key institutions? That sounds like diversity or some strand of.
Well, in Justice O'Connor's opinion in Grutter, she sort of assimilated the two, but unfortunately, in 1978, when the Supreme Court dealt with the Bakke decision, Justice Powell said, listen, forget about trying to rectify past societal discrimination. What's really important is diversity. we'll have better education at our institutions of higher education if we have people from all over the United States.
And you're not sold on that in itself?
Well, I think there's something to it, but I think that it's not nearly, for me, as compelling an argument as the rectification of past oppression.
Stuart Taylor, what about rectification, A and B? What are you kind of anticipating out of this court on this huge issue?
Right. Rectification, I mean, I agree with most of what was just said. Rectification, if we're talking about trying to do what we can without undue cost to make this country more equal racially, to have larger percentages of minority races in leadership positions, and I'm all for that. The question is, how far, when you're talking about racial preferences, are you going to compromise other values to do that? I'm reminded of, for example, a quote by Shelby Steele, who's a black critic of racial preferences. At every university in the country, we'll admit the child of a black doctor ahead of the child of a white cab driver every time. And I might add, even if the child of the white cab driver is better qualified. And so I think, you know, how far do we want to go? We could have a long conversation. What's the court likely to do? I think they will probably award a victory to Abigail Fisher. The big question is whether they will do so in a very narrow way, as Professor Kennedy predicted at first, or whether they will find a way to restrain the size and growth and proliferation and perpetuation of racial preferences, which is on course to continue for more than a century if they don't do something to slow it down.
Well, you've both given us a lot of insight to anticipate that decision and do it more knowledgeably. We're very grateful for that. Stuart Taylor, co-author of the new book out today, Mismatch: How Affirmative Action Hurts Students, Its Intended to Help, and Why Universities Won't Admit It. Stuart, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Randall Kennedy, big book on affirmative action coming out in the spring. We'll watch for that. Randall Kennedy of Harvard Law School, thanks for being here today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Listeners, thanks for all your input. It is beyond measure in value. This is On Point.